Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to So Very Wrong About Games. I'm your co-host, Road Rage Bedraggled Mark Bigney, and with me, as always, is my loyal co-host, Michael Walker. How you doing, Walker?
Always good, Mark.
So while you're listening to this, through the magic of technology, I am probably still in Northern Ontario.
The magic of time travel.
Yes. I've been informed that the voyage cross-country is a magical affair, which I think is an exaggeration, but everyone has stressed that Ontario does not ever end.
Well, you see, you go wait till you get to like Saskatchewan and
you're trying to remember the other prairie
those
province?
Those other places.
Alberta, like Manitoba, Saskatchewan.
Manitoba, yeah. Yeah. You know, that flat airport that you're going to be driving across.
I met a guy from Manitoba once. He said, Manitoba, come for the wheat.
I think magical they mean by people get really high in order to make it across.
That is not what I'm going to be doing, rest assured. So this is a board gaming podcast about board games. We're going to be deviating slightly from the normal formula by virtue of the straitened circumstances. So we're going to talk about the games we played last week, a brief element on the news and why it doesn't matter. Our topic this week is part one of two of our semi-regular omnibus Ask Me Anything, Catch All Questions, period. And those of you who are looking forward to our award-winning segment, So Very Wrong About Games Presents Masterpiece Theater, you're going to have to wait. But on the other hand, there is no other hand. I don't know what that segue was for. So, with that in mind, let us proceed to the games we played last week.
It would have been good if it was like a card game. You could have segued. On the other hand, we played, you know, like a hand of cards.
You know, Walker, that would have been, that's why you're the best in the business right there.
Good right there.
That would have been a solid. On the other hand.
Mark, you played Regicide on Tabletop Simulator.
Woo! Nailed it.
Thank you.
Way to pull us back from the fires of my own incompetence. Yes, Regicide is really fun and really good. I've been saying this all over. It is now, as I said, it is not even part of my gaming bag. It's now in my purse, Walker. I just keep Regicide in my purse that I carry with me all over the place. And the moment there was a tabletop simulator, I knew I had to introduce it to Louis because we play games with Louis regularly online. And the best part is, now when you mouse over a card, it tells you what the name of the character is.
No way.
Seriously. Because during the Kickstarter campaign, they named all of the characters in the 52-card deck. Once again, Regicide is the cooperative game that is based on a standard 52-card deck, but the artwork is so incredibly compelling, and now all these characters have names. Because the amount of personality that leaps off a given card, if you want to pay attention, you don't have to pay attention. It's one of those things where it's like, yeah, I'm playing an eight of spades. Or you could pay attention to the fact that all the eights across all the suits have different character designs, and all the spades look heavily armored, etc., etc., etc. Still haven't won, still haven't come close to winning. We had an excellent session where we got to the penultimate king, which is as far as we got. And then we were roundly trounced. But it's so simple to explain, so fun to play. Not heavy on the cooperation. I mean, I understand why it works that way. You can't tell people what's in your hand. The communication restrictions, if strict, are at least sensible. They're not like, well, you can say something about your cards, just not exactly what they are. And then you have to start parsing, do you have a good spade or do you have a really good spade? Anyway, you just can't talk about it. But still, it's fun and social. You get to marvel at the artwork together. Honestly, this is one of the most surprising finds over the past few years. Regicide has continued to grow and grow. And in terms of full disclosure, this is a review copy we did get from the designer.
That being said, if you find it too hard, that could be like an easy rule to break until you start winning, and then to make it harder, then remove the chit-chat.
Funny you mention that. That is an actual variant for beginners. You can have table talk if you want as an easier experience. But look, you and I both appreciate very hard co-ops. I think you appreciate them far more than I do. I don't mind co-ops that are too easy. QV, the fact that I've played Spirit Island on difficulty level zero dozens and dozens of times. But I do appreciate the fact that it is unrelentingly brutal. And so that's Regicide, my highest possible recommendation.
That being said, we're playing it so often now. I'm wondering if we're finding that it's an obvious play when it's your hand. Like, are you really thinking a turn ahead? Like, I'm going to save these cards for my next play.
Absolutely.
All right.
Well, at the beginning of the game.
At the beginning, for sure.
At the beginning of the game, every suit feels like a waste because so few of the special abilities seem to make sense at the very early on. And so there's tension in how to manage your hand in that sense. Later on, over the course of the game, you start looking at your higher value cards, but then wondering, well, just in terms of our game last night, we were in a position where we desperately needed more card draw, but we'd been sloppy with respect to using hearts, because hearts are what you use to buff up the draw deck, and it doesn't feel as satisfying as any of the special abilities. Every time I play a card, I always wanted to have all four special abilities of the suits. Now, if it's the case that you can kill a boss by the exact margin necessary, and in Regicide what that does is it adds the boss to the deck rather than discarding it out of the game, yeah, sure, it's a gimme. Go ahead and do that. But short of that, I find the card play constantly tense.
That was Regicide. We just finished a game of Pax Viking, and we played it twice now on the Baby Baby Pooh Face level. And I can see why they've done that. I thought of a different reason why while we were just sitting here. One reason is that it's very easy to understand them all.
Yes.
You simply, you know, empty out a track.
And it's easy to look around the table that and see who's doing well.
That is the second reason I just realized, is that you can instantly see how other people are close to winning, as opposed to the other victory points, which are a little more, I don't want to say convoluted, because they're not really that complicated. But
if you're being a little careless, you could miss it.
Yes, yeah. But it is something that you have to get up and sort of count out and look more deeply into. But I am enjoying my plays of Pax Viking. I'm looking forward to finally getting to pull out the more complicated, you know, victory point conditions and seeing how that plays out.
We've been playing on the simplest level because we've been introducing new players, and despite the fact that this is by a large margin the most accessible PAX game, it's still a little counterintuitive in some ways. And it's very, very reliant on keywords, and the keywords mean exactly what they mean and nothing else. And sometimes an action involves three keywords in sequence, and so then if you find a special action or an event card that removes one of those keywords, it's not immediately apparent how that's different, but it can make a tremendous difference. I'm enjoying PAX Viking. I don't know if it has the necessary tempo that I would be looking for, because, again, in the comparison set, it still feels very much like a PAX game, although it's got a weird inverted geography thing, rather than building out a tableau that creates the geography of the map. Instead, you move around a map and build your tableau on the map, effectively. It's solidly, you know, 90 minutes to 2 hours with a large player count, and that's not nothing, but you don't get the same kind of interesting combinatorics that you would get in another PAX game. And so other PAX games that tend to be tighter and leaner or tend to have more interesting card interactions, like, for example, in PAX Viking, a lot of the ventures you're going to play are some variation of get $2, maybe get more dollars if you have something else in the map or something along those lines. And that's fine. I'm not saying it's dull or uninteresting. Just when compared to some of the other card interactions you would get from some of your tableau builders, whether it's a PAX game or whether it's something like Innovation or Race for the Galaxy or something like that, which tend to play in about half the length of time, and it still has a PAX Viking still has a large learning curve, I'm wondering if it might be better to devote that amount of time to learning something else. But I agree with you. PAX Viking has been fun. The accessibility has been interesting, just watching the PAX formula work itself out in a slightly more accessible way. And I will grant that one thing that it has over pretty much any other tableau builder I've ever seen in any other PAX game, its sense of geography is very grounded. In order to play any card, you need to have a boat presence in a very specific place. And that is interesting.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's interesting, but also very procedural, right?
True.
And I think this is what's adding along a lot of the time, because it's an action to get the card, an action to move a boat to the location, and then an action to actually put the card on the, you know, you have to go through many steps in order to do everything. And sometimes that's very, A, frustrating to people because they don't realize they have to go through every single step, or they missed one, or they don't understand how a certain step works. So, you know, you just backtrack. No, it's like, no, you have to first, you know, choose the card from over there. Then you have to move your boat to that actual, you know, very specific part of the map in order to play it. And then now you have to take the play action. And now, you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Very procedural, but I'm interested. Like I said, I do want to try it with the next time I play it. It's either, you know, I can't say I just passed. No, don't invite me. I don't want to play it, but I definitely want to play with the different victory conditions.
I agree. Before making a final decision, I would like to try at least the standard exactly. versions, if not some of the other ones. But I agree with you that it's a little, I don't necessarily call it procedural, but yeah, you do have to do a number of steps in order to get even basic functions accomplished, which is not ideal. So I think it's good, probably not great.
Correct.
And that was our subsequent play of PAX Viking.
We also got to play Dino Tea Party again with more players. It's a fantastic, silly little game with very interesting art, and you can role play a little bit with it, which makes it even more fun. More on role playing in a minute, because we played another fantastic game. But anyway, Dino Tea Party is sort of like an advanced Guess Who. There's these dinosaurs, and they have all sorts of different traits. And you ask your opponent, you know, oh, you seem to have something in your teeth, Mark. Maybe you should get it out. And they tell you whether their teeth are showing or not. And you sort of have to deduce who's who.
I was a little concerned that parsing all the conditions might be a little difficult in person. But no, it was fine. So I agree with you. Advanced Guess Who. Some opportunity for some light role play, delightful art, charming.
That being said, let's move right into a $1 million script. This is a party game from Portal, their first sort of foray into party games. This is a review copy that got sent to us. It's not quite out yet. And what you're doing in $1 million script is you're breaking into two teams. You could do three if you wanted. That does have enough components to do three. And you're pitching a movie to the game master. And you have some conditions on that. You like generate heroes and villains, and you sort of have story elements that you have to work towards. And the director also has traits that you sort of have to, you can play into in order to, you know, sway their decision one way or the other. And I felt very bad that I had to be the game master, Mark. It seemed super fun. And I'm very interested into trying it and being on a team this time. The one thing I did feel is that I think for a party game, it goes a bit long. I think its demand on the role play aspect for like a, not so much for like a gaming party game, like if you have a bunch of gamers and you want to bring them into a party game situation, that's fine. But if you're like normal party games where it's like a code names where you're bringing people who've never played games before, I feel that role play element is a little too demanding for that length of game.
Yes, I agree with you that as far as party games go, it's a little less casual in that sense. It's not really amenable to people going in and dropping out the way you can do in code names. And there is, it's surprisingly intense to have to be able to present things that way. I would present this, I would compare $1 million script to being a slightly more structured version of Snake Oil or other similar kinds of party games where you're making some sort of pitch. I found it borderline tedious. Here's why. The bits where the game was providing structure, it has the system whereby you pull cards to identify certain people with certain backgrounds based on what kind of movie you're pitching. That part was cool, and where you're in a position where you have an established movie pitch, and these persist from round to round. Your movie pitch builds. I don't know what an actual movie pitch looks like, but I could believe that it's somewhat like this. And then suddenly you have to say, well, you know, here's the sidekick. The sidekick happens to be a washed-up politician who's creating a monstrous machine. And you're like, wait, what? And having to work those in, that part I thought was kind of okay. The later rounds where you're just riffing and you're just trying to establish on movie tropes, and it was just improv based on movie structures, that part I found a little bit less engaging. And I kind of was yearning for the simpler one-offs of something like Snake Oil, where it's like, okay, I need to market the Love Stick. Okay. No, it wasn't Love Stick. It was Love Rock. One very salient early gaming experience in Kingston was a riotous game of Snake Oil where Asimi had to pitch the Love Rock, and it was great. I still remember that pitch for the Love Rock. But I do appreciate the fact that it does import a lot of these movie structure elements. The designer, Daniel Stamm, it's one of those things where they say, you know, the designer has experience in Hollywood, and you're like, yeah, sure. He was an AD for 5 days in a secondary shoot from some indie movie, and you look him up, oh, no, Daniel Stamm is legit. He's been involved in a lot of films, a lot of major motion pictures, and so the author of the game is a serious mover in the industry. And the movie structure elements were interesting. I just don't know that they lended it to an hour-long party game of constant improv.
That's right. You go through 5 rounds of introducing these limits to, you know, how far you can go in the story and what elements you're supposed to add. And then you go away and you talk to your teammates to develop this story. And you have to go through 5 rounds of this, which some people might really love, but they should have included, I think, like I said before, 2 different ways to play, like a 3-arc story and a 5-arc story, and choose which one you want to play.
It was the pandering element was fun. You're kind of encouraged to, and Walker did a great job of this, setting it up subtly. The movie producer will subtly intimate that they like certain details. And so then it's incumbent on us. And we actually discovered this organically. This was not, Walker didn't stress this at the beginning. So I don't want to deprive anyone of the joy of discovery. But if you're setting up the game for your group, I would encourage you to not tell them explicitly that the pitch should pander to your preferences. Just let them try it and then respond appropriately. And so we just discovered, based on Walker's scattered comments, that, oh yeah, we should make the dog super salient in the movie. And so we kept twisting, like, how can the dog be part of this scene? And every time we would do that, Walker's eyes would light up. It's like, I like where you're going with that dog scene. So those parts were good. Again, where there was more structure involved and where it was a little more fast moving, I was enjoying myself. But the last couple acts started to drag, and there wasn't enough guidance being offered by the game system to really feel like I was being guided along a game experience rather than just doing miscellaneous improv.
Agreed. And that was Million Dollar Script by
Daniel Stamm
and produced by Portal Games.
We played some more Scapegoat. Scapegoat continues to impress. This is a review copy sent to us by the designer John Perry. And if you want social deduction in about 30 minutes, this is absolutely the way to do it if you want social deduction in small player groups. We have now kind of calibrated our expectations such that that people don't panic quite as much. We commented early on that an overwhelming preponderance of our games were ended by someone running to the cops, and now we know why. That's because we were always playing with Huey, and Huey always runs to the cops. You're a little bit skittish too, I have to say, because in order to catch the scapegoat, you need to have courage and some degree of trust or willing to stick your neck out a little bit. If not, you're just going to hand the victory to the scapegoat because you're just going to run and squeal like some sort of coward. And I have to say that for people, once again, it's the social deduction game for people who don't like social deduction games, but people who do like social deduction games, like me, still appreciate it. And so, another great session or two of Scapegoat.
Yeah, we knocked off two games back-to-back in a very short amount of time. Very easy rules load. Super fun to play. And the art is amazing.
You go to love that art.
You do.
I regret nothing.
We also played a game, Mark, called Sonic the Hedgehog.
This is Sonic the Hedgehog Crash Course.
I didn't have the subtitle here. I'm so sorry.
This is also a review copy we got from the designer Sean Dallas McDonald.
So this is a racing game where you're racing ahead, and if you're the first to get to a map piece, you get some
Flicky Bird.
You get a Flicky Bird, and you can also pick up some equipment.
Everyone gets equipment by going on to a new tile.
Every time you go on a tile, you get equipment. And it could be a boost, or it could be a jump, or a bumper, or something, or a bomb to, you know, damage people. So you're trying to get Flicky Birds, you're trying to push people around. And what it does is a good job of keeping everyone at the same level.
Really?
No one, I didn't feel in our game anyone got very far ahead.
Says the person who is in the lead the entire game.
I was in the lead, but not by two or three spaces. And I didn't win either.
Well, but the thing is, okay, well, here's one of the dynamics that I thought was unfortunate. The primary way to acquire victory points in this race game is to be the first to push on to a new tile. And so you can be in a situation where the leader moves ahead three spaces, because that's as far as you can move absent special items, reveals a new tile, and if other people are three spaces behind, well, they move the three spaces, they move on to the tile again, but they don't get any bonus, so they're neck and neck with the leader, but the leader's getting all the money, and they're not even getting the compensatory benefits of showing up later, because if they, this happens several times to various people, because if you show up to the same space that the leader's on, you're not even considered to be in second place at that moment, you're considered to be tied for first, and so you don't even get more equipment, and that happened a fair bit.
It's true, but then the other players could gang up on the leader, hit them with pullbacks.
Oh, we tried.
And bombs, and damage, and all sorts of fun.
I even tried a chokehold, and that didn't work either.
I think that did go a little bit longer than it should have as well, but I think all in all, it wasn't a terrible experience for the feel and the IP and the expectation.
I agree that as far as race games go, it wasn't over long, but I didn't get any sense of speed. I also didn't like how some of the clever bits didn't really seem to manifest. So, like, for example, there's this idea of rings, which is very much in keeping with the property. They weren't as consequential or salient as I hoped they would be. There's also this idea of making shortcuts, which is geographically cool, and it's a catch-up mechanism. It also feeds into some special abilities. That happened once, in large part because... Oh, no, sorry, it didn't happen once. It would have happened once had Huey not won the game at the turn-up. Anyway, so it never happened.
That's true.
And it's too easy for the leader to prevent there being shortcuts because the leader is the one who controls to a certain extent how the geography of the course is going to go, and it is not in the leader's interests to allow for shortcuts because shortcuts help the rear players catch up, so...
But it comes with these fantastically pre-painted miniatures.
The minis are very nice.
So if you really, really love Sonic, then it will be a reach to enjoy this game.
That was Sonic the Hedgehog Crash Course. Played another game of Babylonia, and I went back to Babylonia because I feel like, Walker, I'm being bullied. People on the internet are telling me that I should like Babylonia more than I do. We did our full review of Babylonia, where we said Babylonia is good, not great, not one of the pantheon of Reiner Knizia's best games, thoroughly enjoyable, solid tile air. No, that's not enough. You have to adore Babylonia, Walker. You have to shave your head, don a saffron robe, and worship at the altar of Babylonia, Walker.
I refuse.
Yeah, so do I. I like Babylonia. I'll play it anytime.
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
Just not one of my favorite Reiner Knizia Italian games. What do you want? I don't like the incremental scoring. I don't like the fact that turns seem a little procedural. The blocking isn't as salient as I would like it to be in other games. When I'm playing a game like Samurai, when I'm playing a game like Through the Desert, even when I'm playing games like Blue Lagoon, I feel like there's more blocking. I feel like there's more dynamism, and I prefer the scoring systems. I'm sorry. I apologize for not thinking Babylonia is the best thing ever. I like it, but I went back to it in part because I keep thinking something must be wrong with me because the internet is gaslighting me, Walker.
How dare you have an opinion?
Apparently, I'm not allowed to have an opinion, or at least not that I'm allowed to have an opinion. That opinion is that Babylonia is the greatest tile-laying game Reiner Knizia has ever made. I just don't happen to have that one opinion.
No. Well, it makes two of us.
It's fun.
It is.
I mean, I recommend it, but there are, you know, 4 or 5 Reiner Knizia tiling games I'd recommend before it. So there you go.
Yeah,
and that's Babylonia by Reiner Knizia.
Production is fantastic. These great
wooden very
discs. Super easy to teach. Much like all other Reiner Knizia games.
Well, with the exception of Tigers and Euphrates. Tigers and Euphrates is a little bit cumbersome to teach. But it's worth it.
And the actions are very straightforward. And the game just comes alive as you play it. Like the strategy and the depth of the game reveals itself as you play.
Absolutely.
And that was Babylonia by up-and-coming designer Reiner Knizia.
And for those following along at home, that is one of your bingo card entrants. Walker's one joke about Reiner Knizia.
There's not much to joke about there.
We played another game of In the Shadow of the Emperor. We played this about a year ago. In the Shadow of the Emperor is a game that was originally published in 2004, back in the days when there was Rio Grande Games and Mayfair, and that's about it. It is effectively a 4-player-only-ish area majority game in which there are some interesting pseudo-political elements. I say pseudo because there's not really a whole lot of negotiation or haggling involved. But there's a lot of collusion possible between players on a number of different axes. That part I find interesting. The other part that I find interesting is there's this idea of your majority pieces, namely your nobles, aging out and dying. So your nobles can get married, which makes them more influential. They can also get older. You can also make them younger, but that's just like treating them with a doctor, giving them an extra 10 years of life, not actually making a 25-year-old shrink into a 15-year-old. Although it's more fun to imagine that that is what's happening.
It's true. It's magical.
It's magical.
And like you said, there's lots of moving parts going on at the same time, and it's great to sort of figure out how they all move because we have action cards that are disappearing. So you have to figure out, you know, what can I get to now? What is the most important action to take? Because it might not be there when it's my turn. What nobles am I going to lose? And where am I going to have to reinforce that awesome mechanism of, like you said, from the beginning, which people didn't sort of grasp,
internalize
right from the beginning, that you don't want to hold houses. You want them to flow because every time they switch hands, there's victory points coming in and out. So you sort of want to take it now, make it weak so someone takes it from you, and then instantly, you know, have those resources to the side that you can take it back and get more points again.
Absolutely. I was actually surprised, and I'd forgotten this, how few movement actions there are. I remember there being more movement. Now, not every game should or could be as dynamic as, say, El Grande, where things are moving all the time. But it felt a little more static than I remembered because you can only move knights around easily, but knights can be dislodged. Your nobles, there's only 2 move actions for your nobles the entire game. Oh, sorry, for every round, not for the entire game. It's kind of a proto-worker placement, actually, because there are these action cards that are available to buy, but they're effectively worker placement spaces. But based on the cards that you take, that will determine whether at the end of the year your family has a son or a daughter, which is also very cool. Anyway, there's lots of nice little bits. It's one of those games where you can find yourself in a conflict with another player, and because of miscalculations on both sides, you can end up in a quagmire that hurts you both. More on that later when we start talking about other games. And that's a little bit unfortunate, but I do keep going back to it over the years. It's the kind of game that I really want to play every couple of years or every 3 or 4 years because it does a number of other things that hasn't been repeated in quite this format before. And I do really like area majority games where the politics are kind of structured in an interesting way. And that is absolutely true of In the Shadow of the Emperor.
Yeah, I think you and I came to the same conclusion at the same time. It's one of those interesting games where the first few rounds, you're putting out so many pieces that the movement of those nobles don't really matter because you're just putting out new ones anyway. And then suddenly when they're all out or you want to move particular ones, you look down at the board and it's like, oh, there's only two cards that can do that. And in a four-player game, they disappear very quickly.
It's true.
Because I think, like I said, they weren't used very much near the beginning, but near the end, they were vital pieces of action.
Absolutely. Also, the player count is a bit of an issue. It's not, in my estimation, really worth the time with three players. So it's pretty much a four-player only experience. But I do love me some somewhat classic small-box Euros, especially when they do something rather interesting. And that is In the Shadow of the Emperor by Ralph Burkert. Finally for me, played another game of Imperium the Contention, and I've got to say, this continues to please. I'm now seeing every faction in play. This time we played with the Supreme Jerklord faction, which has the nasty habit of saying, oh, that's a nice ship you've got there. I guess it's mine now. It's really amazing in that I'm getting slight bits of Cosmic Encounter vibes in that in turn one or turn two, someone could play out a technology and then you think, well, great, how am I supposed to win against something that crazy? And then two turns later, you're playing something that wild. But yet, the game doesn't fly off the rails. And I think that's a non-trivial achievement. The cards all get to do interesting things, which I think if you're going to play a game like this, which is a pseudo 4X experience, fun things should happen. Again, I compare it to Quantum, sort of a pseudo 4X-y game with lots of conflict and lots of interesting special powers. And I think that Imperium is kind of injects a little bit of the sort of Magic the Gathering feel, both because you can do some deck construction if you're inclined, and because the combat system is reminiscent of that. You know, I've got a 4-3 ship and it's fighting your 5-2 ship or what have you. I still haven't played with four players, which everyone says is the ideal player count. But I've thoroughly enjoyed it with two. I thought it was shockingly solid with three, and I'd still happily play it with three. And I'm looking forward to more content. Apparently the designer has been soliciting feedback for expansion ideas. And there's also a solo campaign, which I'd very much like to try, and which I might have to try when I'm all alone, crying myself to sleep in Vancouver. And that is my further experience with Imperium the Contention.
Vancouver tears. The sweetest of tears.
And those are the games we played last week. And now on to a brief segment of news and why it doesn't matter. Walker, what's in the news?
Board Game Arena, a few months ago, did a New Year's sort of spectacular where they had 30 days of a new game every day. Now they're expanding that to 62 days of a new game every day. So for the next 2 months, we'll have a new game come out of beta into the general populace.
Anything cool yet?
Nothing yet. We've had Chinese checkers and hand and foot, one game I've never heard of before. But who knows, maybe we'll get some more exciting titles soon. And my second piece of information is Ruins of Arnak has now shot up again because they announced an expansion where players will now have unique powers. So that might be somewhat interesting, which it needs.
Sure, a little bit more variety, a little bit more spice. You know, the game wasn't bad, but it just felt a little smoothed out.
Exactly.
Only one bit of news for me, and it's very, very sad. Apparently, the license to Blue Moon, which had been held by a publisher, has now reverted back to Rainer Knizia. And so we are not staring down the barrel of a reprint to one of the greatest games ever made, which is very, very sad. I appreciate the fact that Rainer Knizia is kind of an industry unto himself. He's got, you know, levels of business, and he's kind of like a franchise, and so I have no doubt that him and his various business partners will be sending out feelers to try to get back into print someday soon, but who knows, because that description could apply to any one of hundreds of designs of his at any given moment.
Who knows? Who knows what it'll be re-themed to as well?
I don't know, man. Blue Moon has so much proprietary art, I'd be shocked if they decided to re-theme it and redo all that artwork. That'd be very surprising, but conceivable. Another Animal Gangsters game, maybe?
Oh, that's what I have to ask. Is it all part and parcel? Art, everything else is all part and that reverts back? Does the art assets remain with...
So I don't know the specific details about this. I imagine that one of the complicating factors of trying to reprint Blue Moon is that every people was illustrated by a different artist. And so the rights complication might be more complicated there, or at least more expensive. I don't know who owns the rights to that, but I assume if Rainer Knizia's business interests are the ones that are trying that were in a position to grant the license out to other publishers, that it is somehow at least held through Rainer Knizia, if not held by Rainer Knizia. And that is the news and why it doesn't matter. On to our topic for the week. I here use the term week advisedly because time has no meaning. Omnibus questions. So we've compiled a whole bunch of your questions, and we are going to address about half of them now. We're going to address the remaining half, and you can keep sending in questions up until the day of, and if we're inclined to answer them, we will. You can either post them on the guild, guild number 3236. There's a topic there, or you can email them to Walker, justrolledadice@gmail.com. That's justrolledadice@gmail.com. And so we've got a whole bunch of questions from our listeners to answer, so let's get to it, Walker. I would like to hear your response for the first question, because I have my version. What is the meet cute for you and me?
I had to look that up, what it meant, Mark.
Oh, you didn't know? Okay.
I didn't know. Mark, it was a hot summer in Ontario, so I drove up to the sandbanks, parked the car, pulled out my copy of Space Hulk, and tucked it under my arm.
This isn't going to be serious, is it?
I started walking along the beach.
I feel like I saw the normal crowds.
I saw the soccer players, the volleyball players, and I thought to myself,
"You're mocking me.
When is it going to be my turn?" And then in the distance, Mark, I saw it. What is that person doing?
Could you tell me when you're
He's
done?
He's playing like, a board game.
Hold a sign
and
this, or something?
And it was Mark. He was doing Tigris and Euphrates strategic moves. And I don't know what made him look up at that moment.
I know you don't value my time. But
he looked up.
The listener's time.
And our eyes met.
Yeah.
And he looked down at my copy of Space Hulk. And we started to run towards each other.
In slow motion?
In the surf. And just as... And the rest of the story will be on our OnlyFans page. Swag OnlyFans. That's SVAG OnlyFans.
Well, I was going to take this endeavor seriously because I'm a professional broadcaster. But no, I remember very distinctly. I was moving to Kingston after having lived in a variety of places elsewhere. I never really successfully integrated myself into the gaming scene in Toronto for a variety of reasons, many of them my own fault. And so I said, I'm going to be here in Kingston long term. At least I thought. Well, more on that later.
You're coming back.
I know. More on that later. So I'm going to make an effort. Because this was actually pointed out by Efka from No Pun Included on Twitter. It's the tragedy of a lot of board gamers. I'm not going to say this is true of all board gamers. I'm not painting with a broad brush. But a lot of board gamers really love board games, don't really like socializing that much, right? But the two go hand in hand. You need to find willing victims. I mean participants. I mean test subjects. I mean friends. That's the word I'm looking for.
There we go.
And so I thought I was going to be strategic. Like, okay, who seems to be the social linchpin here that I need to get in good with? Not necessarily ingratiate myself, but just figure out that they're the people who organize things and or know when things are going down, right? Initially, I thought it was going to be a mutual friend of ours, El Guapo, also known as the Wendigo, also known as the Yeti, also known as the North Wind. He's a figure of legend. That turned out to be false, but it was through El Guapo that he said, oh, a friend of mine is hosting a board game that we're going to play Orléans. You should come. And I'm like, am I invited by him? Because I'd seen Walker around, but I hadn't been invited by Walker. I said, no, it's fine. It's fine. So that felt awkward. But when I went into I think it was your mother's basement where it was being hosted, and I saw tabletop miniature stuff everywhere, and we were playing Orléans. I'm like, yep, this is the guy. That was the sign that I knew that we were definitely headed in the right direction, because anybody that has a lot of tabletop miniatures terrain and wants to play a Euro is my kind of gamer. And that, to me, that wasn't the first time we met, but that was the first time when I realized, wait a minute, this is the guy I need to get in with.
I think it was
How am I doing?
Pretty good. did we play Tigris and Euphrates that night? But I remember because that was the first time.
No, we played Orléans, and then I suggested we play Tigris and Euphrates afterwards.
Gotcha. No, but it was that same night is what I meant.
I don't think so.
No? Okay. But anyway, I know it was that's when I knew. It's when I didn't have to explain to you what Tigris and Euphrates was.
Sure. Oh, maybe it was that night. No, I remember. Back in the days when we used to play two games back to back.
Could have been.
Yep.
Back when I had that thing. What was it again?
Time.
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 That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah. So what make Mark decide to move? It's for family reasons, not tragedy. It's good family reasons. And I'm going to be in Vancouver for either 6 months or a year. What happens at the end of the 6 months, if I do leave Vancouver at the end of the 6 months, I'm going back to Cambridge, Massachusetts. So I'm going to be away from Kingston for about a year. But don't worry, it's not going to be forever. And we are going to keep up the podcast in the meantime. All right, next up.
Given that the rate of new games seems to be accelerating, how do you expect to handle these opportunities in the future? I have been more picky, making sure I don't tailor my choices, i.e., I always have to rein myself in thinking that we need to play this game because that's where our listeners seem to be headed, or this is where our play group seems to enjoy these type of games. I always have to pull back and just say, no, Mike, you know, you do this for a reason. You need just to, you know, grab the games that are interesting to you and to you alone.
I agree. Any time I've tried to acquire something because I specifically thought that, well, the listeners expect us to talk about this game or something, I've usually been A, wrong, and B, disappointed. So I end up producing content that's not as good and that nobody asked for. And so being guided by your own interests and indeed scaling back, as you say. Now, there are going to be games that are going to be left behind. Our newsletter for this month is talking about precisely that. We wanted to play Sleeping Gods and we wanted to play more Oath. Neither of those two things is going to happen before I leave. Now, maybe after I leave something will happen. Who knows? There are necessarily going to be things we wanted to get played that are not going to happen. But such is the way of things. I'm just glad that we're still able to find the time to go back to 10, 20, 30-year-old Euros, like the occasional play of Lancaster, like the occasional play of Shadow of the Emperor, just to pick out two recent examples. And just accepting that, you know, sometimes the hot new thing is not going to be something that we're going to experience.
That's right. And read more rule books that I also have here.
Yeah, that's helpful.
This will be more for you, I think, this next one. Mark, it says, so. What makes attritional combat as an Innis bad, and will you give Innis another chance with the We Need a King module?
Innis is another game, much like Babylonia, where I'm not allowed to have the opinion. I don't like Innis very much. I'd play it again, honestly, if somebody put in front of me. If people really like it, I'd play it again. I wouldn't get up and leave rather than play Innis, and I wouldn't insist on imposing my will. I'm not particularly inspired to give it a chance with the We Need a King module. People rave about it. That was not one of the problems I had with the game. The end game was not an issue that I had with Innis. Now, as far as attritional combat is concerned, attritional combat isn't always bad. It's sometimes okay if it's a very minor element and the attritional combat still has some elements of transactionality about it. The two examples that I would give are Antica and Imperial. That's purely attritional combat, but it works okay because combat is a minor element of the game and you can't get stuck in quagmires for no appreciable gain. That's the problem with Innis. One small mistake on either an attacking player or a defending player, congratulations, the game spirals out of control. And not even in a way where like one player demonstrably is hurt and needs to rebuild. In a way that every player is substantially affected and the game state itself suffers. That's one of the main problems that I have with Innis. Oh, but Mark, smart players don't do that. Yes, of course, if you only play with smart players, that's fine. But I like when games are a little more robust and they can't be ruined by a simple fight that someone pulls mistakenly. Anyway, no more on Innis, please. Walker, what's your ideal game that hasn't been made?
I hope it never will, Mark.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
Do tell.
Well, just because. Then what is next? Right? If your ideal's game made, then you're just like, oh. It's like some of the funnest moments in what we do is finding that one little mechanism that meshes with another mechanism.
That's true.
Or, you know, finding a new way to manipulate things. And that is one of the things I love about this hobby. And if I had to like nail a game down, I think I'm going to talk about it later on, and that would be level 7 Invasion. Mm-hmm. It just sort of has that buckets of plastic. It's cooperative.
It does tick a lot of boxes for you, yeah.
Yeah, it's got the fact that you can upgrade units. It has an amazing theme. It has multiple things going on at once.
Yep. Yeah, that is kind of your ideal game, isn't it?
It is.
The ideal game for me that hasn't been made is probably some kind of grand strategic Reiner Knizia negotiation game. Because I love me grand strategic negotiation games. The upcoming game by Phalanx Coalitions looks right up my alley. And oh my goodness, it's probably not going to be very good, but I'm so excited. I'm so excited. And Reiner Knizia does good negotiation and trading games. Quo Vadis is really good. He did a number of other Roman-themed games that involved trading and negotiation. Worked really nicely. So if for whatever reason he were inspired to do some sort of grand strategic negotiation game, I think that would probably be right up my alley. But I don't see it happening, and that's fine. I agree with you. The imperfections of games are sometimes more... You know, that's deep. That's so deep, Walker.
It's got layers right there.
It's layers and depth.
This one, next one must be for you as well, because I'm... What are your thoughts on Magic the Gathering? Like, I don't even know what that is.
I am... I mean, I'm glad that it exists because it keeps game stores in business.
It's true.
Because I'm sure as hell not keeping them in business.
I'm just wondering at this point, is there too much of a barrier to entry? Like, there's so much more rules out there now. So many, like, pages and pages of keywords.
Well, if you're playing certain formats, that's the thing. There's so many different formats in Magic the Gathering. There are very accessible ones.
True. And then there's, like, this whole timing mechanism that...
Oh, yeah, the stack.
The stack.
I haven't played Magic the Gathering in 25 years, so I'm not in a position to comment. But I'm glad it exists for market reasons.
Yeah, for market reasons and the whole genre that it brought, this sort of CCG sort of deck building
yep.
thing. I appreciate all of that. And the number of artists that they've been able to employ and, mm-hmm. and bring along. Happy for all of that.
Well, it also, come to think of it, introduced the notion of a professional tabletop games player. Sooner or later, that might trickle down into something I'm good at.
This is true, yeah, definitely, yeah. And
wow. Given that I'm good at precisely two games, I think, then I might be waiting for a
actually,
while.
Actually, I'm in the opposite field for that. I'm not a fan of the fact that
sure.
it brought tournaments into gaming. I think that's what just took me out of Warhammer altogether.
And it's fair.
And anyway, let us move on. How do you teach people to be gracious losers or winners?
I have no idea, and if you do, please tell me.
I don't. I just say give them a hard time either way.
Well, that's the thing. That's the only tool I have in my toolbox.
Yeah.
Giving people a hard time. It doesn't work. I know it doesn't work, and yet I keep going back to it.
Would I say it doesn't work? I think it works.
Okay.
I do think it works.
All right. Well,
if you just give them like...
You are a parent and you also have a dog, so I must defer to your experience of training people to act a certain way.
Well, I wouldn't make it that brutal, but sure.
No, I didn't mean that in a bad way. It's just setting expectations and trying to model certain kinds of behavior. I've never been very good at persuading people to act in a certain way. Playing with ideas, I can sometimes do, but trying to change behavior,
Maybe it's just saying dude a lot, like, dude.
That's okay. A corollary of that, do you have tips for parents to deal with children that cannot lose against their parents in competitive games? Oh, here's the thing. I've been accused of not wanting to play with kids. That's not true. Back in pre-pandemic times, I played with kids all the time. Deal up a hand of cockroach poker, deal up a hand of skull, deal up a hand of any number of dexterity games. I'm happy to play any number of games with children. But... The thing is, when they start acting badly, I know it's not my problem.
My only advice would be just to put the game away. That's what I have here. You just,
oh, yeah?
If they start, you know, you don't say, oh, okay, don't worry, you know, you just put it away and you don't stop putting it away and you put it on the shelf and you say, we're done.
Sure.
And then, you just continually do that until they realize that that is why the game is being put away. And then they will stop. I shouldn't say that they will stop.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. It's been my experience that they will stop doing...
That's good advice.
What makes the game stop. Because deep down, they want to play that game.
One helps,
they want
yeah.
to interact with you.
Yeah.
They want to have fun with you. And if you just end it, they will
and
realize
learning
why.
To be a good loser is a very important character trait. It is supremely important. I have a special... additional question here, Walker, that I would like to add to the schedule. How did you get so wise?
By failing a lot. There is an antidote, Mark, that says you learn from your mistakes.
Anecdote, yeah.
And it is true.
So I've got an answer to this. Are you going to go to a convention at some point or do a meetup?
Well, the vaccines are going out.
Yep.
People are meeting in person. So I'm assuming that the meetup in Kingston will start again soon. So I probably still won't be going to that.
When the game store opens back up and has its regular night, you're not going to do that anymore?
Because it starts when usually asleep.
That's true.
Because
I
do very early mornings.
That's
but
true.
I'm going to probably make the exception because our normal in-person gaming is going to be cut off. So in order to get some in-person gaming and get some games played, I might have to make an exception.
I will say that my enthusiasm for convention environments or meetup environments has skyrocketed since the pandemic. So if there's something sufficiently local, if we're invited, if there's something like, am I going to go and try to organize some event from the ground up? No, because I don't know if there's enough interest and that, you know, that seems like a strange way to get yourself back into the scene. But as far as attending local events, absolutely 100% once they start up again. That is my intention. All right, Walker, how big is your collection?
It is fractionally smaller than it was. A couple years ago, I did a massive purge where I went from probably, oh, I don't even know, Mark, 300, 400 down to less than 100. It's up there again now because of the newer stuff coming in. But so I think I haven't counted, but I think I'm at about 100 now.
Board Game Geek says, I own 986 games, 494 of those are expansions, so effectively 500 games, some of them with expansions. I might have a bit of a problem.
Moving on. Yeah, no comment. No, it's not a problem. I don't think it's a problem at all. It's a problem if you're not feeding your family and you're making other sacrifices, then it's a problem.
Well, I'm waiting for lots to come in so I have something to feed my family.
There you go.
Yeah.
Because there's lots there. Mark, what sort of music do you listen to?
My two favorite artists are Tool and Local H. So prog-ish, metal-ish rock and grunge rock, respectively. When I was, I still have a love for folk music from Harry Chapin and Yusuf Islam and Jim Croce and stuff like that. But mostly it's rock music. I do listen to a little bit of everything with the exception of non-Johnny Cash country, which I don't listen to, except for all due respect to Our Lady of Perpetual Vaccines, Dolly Parton, for whom I have endless respect and admiration. But yeah, mostly rock.
Yeah, I listen to almost all music but country, but like you said, Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash is the exception. Yeah, everyone likes Johnny Cash. Yeah.
Exactly. And if we're to pick out bands, I am a huge Kiss fan, Metallica, Diane Word, and dubstep.
Yeah, Walker, my perception is, Walker, that you mostly like stuff from, you know, 80s, more like mid to late 80s, as opposed to like mid to late 90s.
No, that's right. No, this question is, what sort of music do you like? Yeah.
Yeah.
So actual music. Yeah, so the 80s stuff.
Well, it's weird. This is one of those things where I think our generational difference, which doesn't manifest itself frequently, does. Like music, the music that that you like is often like hard-coded into you when you turn about 18 or so, right?
I wonder about that. But I'm thinking about that because it's always the adage where it's like, my music was better. But
sure.
I do listen to a lot of newer stuff.
You do, yes, absolutely.
I
listen to older stuff too.
But then I listen to a Tom Petty song,
uh-huh,
and I realize that none of that stuff is true. The older stuff is better.
I'm not going to go that far. I have a hard time finding new music to listen to because, number one, I like alternative hip hop and not, I don't like Drake. I like Mos Def or Yasiin Bey, whatever he's calling himself this minute, and Black Star and Talib Kweli and stuff like that, which is not really the sort of dominant stream of hip hop. I'm not judging other hip hop. I'm not saying it's bad. It's just, so I don't really like that. Pop music is really hit or miss for me. I do like some pop music, but that's difficult. And the overwhelming majority of new rock releases is either indie rock or very much in the indie rock sound. And that's not my taste. And I come from this honestly. I lived in Montreal before Arcade Fire signed their record deal. So I'm a hipster of disliking Arcade Fire. Anyway, we could talk about music for hours, but moving on.
All right, next question is El Grande, Tigris and Euphrates, and Gloomhaven. Kill one, play one last time, and then never again, or marry one, as in keep it in your collection forever.
So this was asked on the forum by Sam. Sam asked this question, I think, because he knew it would cause me pain.
And Sam was one time a friend until this question.
I used to like Sam.
Exactly.
I used to think Sam was a good guy. I thought he was a countryman. Yeah. I thought he was a member of La Patrimoine.
I never mistaken a person's personality before this badly.
It was really bad, yeah. What do you? Well, Walker, this is easier for you because you don't like El Grande nearly as much as I do.
And then that, and I'm going to cheat, right? Because El Grande, I'm not a huge fan of.
Yeah.
Gloomhaven, I'd play one more time because, like I said, I'm going to cheat and say, well,
say it's a campaign.
Campaign, and you play the entire campaign.
That was the cheat that I thought of too.
And and yeah, I would keep Tigris and Euphrates.
I would actually give the same responses, even if honest. El Grande is a seminal classic, and I love playing it, and I would definitely feel a tremendous harm if it were removed from existence. But when compared to Tigris and Euphrates and Gloomhaven, I'm afraid it's not quite at that level. Now, in terms of influence, if this were more like a fourth dimensional perspective, which game never would have existed, well, then my answers are completely different, 100%. Then I would actually say write Gloomhaven out of existence because the world doesn't need more dungeon crawlers trying to be like Gloomhaven, right? And then El Grande absolutely has to still be in existence because of its tremendous influence in Euro development and showing how conflict and dynamism can be introduced in the Eurosphere. But anyway, that's kind of a digression. So if I had to pick on those terms, I'd play Gloomhaven one last time, keep Tigris and Euphrates in my collection, and I'd write El Grande out of existence. But actually, again, cheating, I would write Sam out of existence.
Ooh.
He deserves it. This question, he deserves it. This is self-defense.
Exactly. It's true. All right, next question. Do you consider playing certain games for the podcast research/work rather than play? I'd said nope. And if I ever sensed that in Mark, I would also stop.
I agree. There have been times when I've been tempted and I've managed to pull myself back. There's one exception, though. If we have planned and committed to doing a feature game and we know we don't like it, we do feel like sometimes we have to keep playing it just to make sure that we're giving it a fair shake, to be able to fully appreciate its deficiencies and its advantages. But other than that, no, I don't really consider it work. Unless you're a member of the Canadian Revenue Association, in which case it's absolutely work, and all these things are tax deductions.
Agreed. Is roll to hit on a 5+ outdated?
Hell no.
Hell no.
Hell no.
Especially if it's in a dice pool.
Yeah, if you mass enough dice, absolutely. Like claustrophobia-style combat where you... No, of course not.
Or even in the Space Hulk instance where it's only a couple of dice, I'm fine with that as well.
You're right.
As long as they're not like D20s or D8s, it's perfectly fine.
Yeah, especially since Space Hulk has that great sustained fire element.
Exactly.
Assuming with sustained fire.
Yes.
There are versions of Space Hulk without sustained fire. Let us not speak of these versions.
Never again.
Is liking or disliking certain games a deal breaker to use a user as a geek buddy? For me, yes. I've talked about this before. This is picking up on a specific thread when I mentioned that I have cultivated a list of geek buddies on BoardGameGeek to help me judge things. To get on my geek buddy list, you need to have one of two things: either really, really good comments, the kind that I used to try to put in games, but I don't have time. I don't really leave comments anymore in games. It's a bad habit. I'm trying to get back into it. Or you need to have unpopular fringe opinions that let me know that you might also have other unpopular fringe opinions that are at least useful to see. So, for example, when I was crafting my initial list of geek buddies, I was looking for people who really liked Euro games but didn't like Power Grid. That was kind of my metric. So if you had a rating of like 6 to lower of Power Grid, that was one way to get me to look at you. Another thing is Battlestar Galactica. If you didn't like Battlestar Galactica, gave it a low rating, that also made me take a hard look at you.
And I don't use the Geek Buddy system, but the only thing I had here was the fact that some people listen to the podcast and they don't like anything we say, but they use that information.
Yep.
You know, to curate their decisions.
One of my favorite pieces of feedback, yeah. I don't agree with any of your tastes, but I still find what you have to say useful.
Exactly. What are your top five What are your top five characters or entries in any game?
Entities?
Ah. What are your top five characters or entities in any game?
Okay, I've actually answered this question twice.
That's good, because I haven't at all, so that's
yeah, so perfect. I'll take your... I kind of thought that would happen, so I prepared in advance to do it twice over. First of all, non-licensed properties. All right? In no particular order, Shadows Flicker Like Flame from Spirit Island, Kaja from Vengeance, Malevolent Life Forms from Race for the Galaxy. I love those Malevolent Life Forms. They look like they're ready to go to bat for me. Grill from Street Masters, and Shona Carano from Aristea. Shona Carano, by the way, is everything I love about the Infinity Universe. Shona Carano is a Spanish woman wielding a Scottish sword with an Austrian hussar coat. And oh my goodness, she is badass.
So, I was going to say, I don't have a list just because I normally just like playing all of them. I always like trying to find different strategies or different ways to bring out different parts of their decks or characters, sure, or abilities. So I really just don't have.
Then there's my list of five licensed characters. Sagat from Street Fighter. He's been adapted several times. Actually, usually pretty well. Han from The Fast and the Furious, who's definitely one of the coolest men on film. Pearl from Steven Universe, who's been adapted a couple times. Terry Bogard from King of Fighters. And Immanuel Kant. Not really a license, but I'm going to call it one.
Oh, I see. I thought this was like in a particular game rate them. But this is just across the... Gotcha. Mark, do you store games vertically or horizontally? Or maybe diagonally?
Almost purely horizontally. I stack them. Most of the time I find that when there are cool inserts, they don't work well when they're standing up. Plus, it's just harder to make efficient use of shelf space when they're standing up.
Well, I do the Calyx system, so I do all my stuff vertically. Unless, like you said, there's some big games or some other games that just don't work well vertical, then I have a couple boxes just for horizontal games.
Relatedly, what is your preferred way to organize inside game boxes? Loose bags, included inserts, aftermarket inserts, a mix?
It's almost 99% loose bags. Inserts usually get chucked to the side the moment I open the box. Mostly just because I store them vertically. So, you know, bags, you put all the heavy stuff on the bottom because you know you're going to put things in vertically.
I am always suckered by the siren song of the almost perfectly functional insert. You know, the thing that has wells for everything but doesn't quite work properly? I find it so hard to part with those. Otherwise, I ditch inserts, no problem. And third-party aftermarket inserts, I almost always find to be a waste of money and space. And you actually have a specific story about this, Walker, because for one thing, many games I feel don't need it. The setup is simple enough. And so often, and this is an absolute deal-breaker for you, I'm never going to get a third-market aftermarket insert if it's the case that I have to collate player material from several different trays. One of the advantages of a bag system is you can just throw a bag at somebody, oh, you're playing red, here's all the red stuff. And if you have an insert system where it's like, okay, well, here's your two things from this tray, and here's your three things from this other tray, why did I give this company $50 to make my life more difficult?
Yeah, if I save anyone money, don't buy an insert for Scythe. There is no point. All of the components get used almost immediately, except for some of the resources. Everything else goes on your player boards and immediately goes out into play. You just throw people the bags, and you're ready to go. There's no point. I've like had to get rid of it. Plus, all the stuff doesn't fit in even the giant box.
Yeah,
with the insert.
All right. What is your favorite Knizia game from each decade he has been published? So I'm going to skip the 80s. I know he published in the 80s, but I didn't really play anything of his from the 80s. So for me, from the 90s, it's obviously Tigris and Euphrates. From the aughts, it's Blue Moon. Now the teens, so 2010 to 2019, is actually really tricky for me because between 2005 and about 2015, he entered what I would consider to be his kind of slow period. He didn't really release a whole lot of games calibrated to my taste, a whole lot of reprints, a whole lot of apps, a whole lot of family games, things like that. But there was a surprisingly good burst of output near the end, and I'd have to say that it would be The Quest for El Dorado, The Golden Temples. It would be my favorite from the teens, but there's some competition there. And then from 2020 to 2021, the current decade, I would have to say it's Well Riders, which is definitely a very, very, very good design, and I'm happy to say that of the 2 years, it's my favorite of his from those 2 years.
I'm fairly close to the same. Tigris and Euphrates. Then in the 2000s, Lord of the Rings. Had a great game for Lord of the Rings.
Definitely very influential. Ahead of the curve in terms of co-ops, no doubt.
In the teens, it would be Yellow and Yancey. And then in just currently, I think Whale Riders and Llama Dice, you know, are head-to-head, in my opinion.
Walker, what was the last game that greatly surprised you by how much you enjoyed it?
I think it was actually what we just talked about was Whale Riders. When I read the rule book, it seemed very straightforward and basic with no nuance. But once we played it, because we just got finished playing the card game, which was, I don't want to say painful, but painful. And I thought, oh my God, the board game looks like it's just much the same. It was a very nice surprise.
For me, it's probably a toss up between Imperium the Contention and Regicide. I didn't have very high expectations for either of them, and they've both proven to be thoroughly enjoyable. Probably the edge goes for Regicide, just for how much mileage it gets out of a simple standard deck of cards. What are the cornerstone games that gamers who are diving deep should try to make a point of playing at least once? Okay, I have some criticisms about some of the implied premises of this question, but I will answer it later. Walker?
keep saying Tigers and Euphrates over again, but it's a great conflict game.
Oh, yeah.
Great balance scoring where you're not just, you know, hitting the same thing over and over again. Kalis is a great, another great core worker placement game back to the, like, blocking positions where it actually matters. Agricola is a great, you know, heavy worker placement sort of, you know, manage, pay your workers because, you know, we got to pay your workers.
Got to pay all your workers now.
Scythe is a great one for, you know, tableau building, showing you have your space, pushing.
It's not tableau.
Sorry. Pushing stuff off your board.
It's okay.
Making your own little engine builder.
We don't have to
however
agree.
However you want to call it. Yeah. I think it's just an all-round. Hits a whole bunch of mechanisms that are great. And Gaia Project, because it's just a great Euro, another solid resource management game.
I want to stress once again that I don't think there's a list of games that you have to have played to be a serious gamer or to be a gamer at all. Like all these labels that people get thrown, oh, you're not a real gamer.
I wish I could say that, Mark, but I was just on Twitch this morning playing Splendor,
mm-hmm.
and someone came on and said they had not played Splendor, and I had to right click on their name
and block them
and remove them from
because they're clearly
from Twitter.
Not a gamer.
I've got the power for the Twitter board game area, and they were done.
Yeah, no, I don't buy that. But I do recognize that there's a certain activity. You know, when people, I've said this before, I'm repeating myself, but whatever. When you're immersing yourself in a new hobby, sometimes you want to reach up on the back catalog. Like, again, with music, right? Like, I want to get into rock music. I want to see where it came from. I want to start listening to things like Little Richard. I want to start listening to some blues so I understand where rock came from. You know, stuff like that. And if you want to do that with board games, but that's a big if. That's a huge if. I'm not saying this is necessary. I would probably say some of the seminal stuff, mostly from the 90s, actually. I would say, yeah, Tigers and Euphrates. I would say El Grande. I would say Space Hulk. I would say probably, I don't know, maybe there's a later tableau builder. Probably Race for the Galaxy, just because of how many tableau builders have come following it. Off the top of my head, that's what I'd have to say. But if you told me to include any sort of gaming canon of the seriously influential games over the past few years or the representative of their types, I'd probably then want to look into more miniature stuff, into more tabletop wargamey stuff. But off the top of my head, those are the four that come to mind.
Yeah, and also I have to say, if you know someone that's deep diving, you just tell them that they have to find something that they relate to or some sort of theme that they can grab onto and just have enjoy playing, right? Because there's no particular game. Because there's such varied tastes.
If you enjoy getting a historical context from something, absolutely. Fill your boots and go find those older titles. If not, don't force yourself. Like, especially not for cred, right? That seems like one of the silliest reasons to do anything.
Yeah, especially because, like you said, the older games are good, but some of these newer games have taken those core mechanics and developed them into such...
Some of them, yes.
Yeah, some of them. I'm not saying every game.
You said every game. I'm joking. You didn't say every game.
Liar! and just done more things. So some of the newer games might be just a better fit as well.
Oh, absolutely. Some of them might absolutely be a better fit, yes.
This next one, I just need to quickly remind Mark that we're probably already at the hour mark.
Yeah, yeah.
And going another, like, hour and a half.
You're the one wasting our time now. Just do it.
I'm just saying the sand timer started,
yep.
So yeah.
All right, go ahead.
Does Battletech count as Macross or a Macross-adjacent game?
No. With the understanding that gateway games are likely either insulting or irrelevant, I dispute this characterization. There has been some discussion about filler game as a title being somewhat dismissive. I see where that's coming from. But then there are some people say, oh, well, you know, calling it a gateway game is insulting. I disagree entirely. And there are many, many gateway games that I would happily play any day of the week. And so I don't know where this...
Yeah, no, I'm
implied denigration is coming
from.
Yeah,
I didn't understand I understood the question, but I don't agree with any of the questions.
I don't agree with that statement either.
There are great gateway games that have their own sort of traits, like as in they're very easy to teach.
Yes.
People can start playing them right away, they understand, and it just makes them great games. Some of them are just core good games. Like
absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think, so if you're asking me how would I go about introducing someone from the hobby, I would absolutely start with many of the things that are classified as gateway games. But I've had more success not trying to tailor mechanisms, but tailoring a theme. Like if somebody really gravitates towards a visual style, start them with that. So, you know, one way you can do this is literally, if you have a collection or if you have access to a collection, lay out 2, 3, or 4 games that you think are appropriate for the time length and their ability to handle rules and say, this one is nominally about X, this one's nominally about Y. And they say, oh, that looks pretty. Then set it up. So if they find the if they really like the cute pictures of porpoises in Whale Riders, by all means, set up Whale Riders. Don't necessarily pitch them Whale Riders because you think the market elements will appeal to them because they're a bean counter in real life or something. I don't know. You get the idea.
So I don't know. Is this one as loaded as I think it is? And how is it? How easy is it for either of you to separate the art from the artist, so to speak?
I find it very easy. The point is not. I assume this is about some of our statements in the past.
That's what I'm wondering.
No, I find it extremely easy to separate the art from the artist. The point is we have a platform and we have the ability to sort of amplify, not to puff us ourselves up too much. I'm not saying that we move a whole bunch of units, but we have an hour or so every week where we get to talk about what we want to talk about, and we don't want to talk about people that are jerks. So,
yeah, that's what I have. It says there's so much out there, and if we get to... If we don't want to talk about certain things for certain reasons, then we don't.
Yeah, but many of these games I still very much enjoy because it's in the privacy of your own home. It's a different kind of thing. If these are, it's complicated. But our refusal to talk about games by certain designers is completely independent from our ability to necessarily enjoy those games by those designers.
Exactly, we have a responsibility, I think, to our listeners to bring certain things to light. And
absolutely.
We will.
Which game is least like Mage Knight?
Your mom. That's what I've written here.
Well, here's the thing. When it comes to Mage Knight, there's a lot of interlocking systems, and so naturally it ends up being compared. But if I wanted to think of a game that's least like Mage Knight, I would probably think of Your Mom.
What is the worst game of the best game you've ever played?
So the worst session, I think, of the best game we've ever played. I had some bad sessions of Tigris and Euphrates where people didn't really grasp what was going on, and they just went off in the little corner and just played tiles for points. That's all they ever did. They didn't seek out conflicts. They didn't prepare themselves for conflicts. They didn't do anything like that. They just thought that, you know, it's a tile-laying game, so clearly all I should be doing is just laying these tiles on individual little atomistic elements, kick them out of a kingdom, and they're like, okay, well, I'll just go start another all the damn time. Not their fault. I mean, just because it's the greatest game ever made doesn't mean it's for everybody. But I've had one or two sessions that were just like that, and it was a bit painful. Also because I just felt bad because as the game explainer, I probably hadn't done a good job of preparing them for it.
Yeah, I don't have a specific game here, but it's one of those things where maybe someone doesn't grasp a certain rule or they misread a rule and their whole game was based around going towards a certain strategy that didn't exist or they misinterpreted, and then it just turns the whole session sour.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
What is the best game of the worst game you've ever played? I have a very specific session in mind for this.
I think you have the same one.
I think so too.
It'd be hilarious. I have Starship Samurai.
Sweet. We had so much fun playing Starship Samurai because we were just ripping the game the entire time.
Yes.
One of us would play a card, and the target of the take that card would be like, okay, wee! And it was just, we loved playing the game, and we hated the game.
Yeah, it was so bad. So bad.
Some people like their co-ops brutally, near impossibly difficult, and others won't have fun unless they know they can win. Where do we fall on the spectrum?
I like them very difficult. And if you know for sure if you want to win every time, then just cheat.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, the whole needing to win every time, I can't help but feel that that's a weird competitiveness.
I think we're reading into it too. It doesn't say that they have to win, but that they can win.
Theoretically? Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be interesting. I wouldn't necessarily rule out the intrigue of a co-op game that said it is impossible to win this game. If it was done well.
I was supposed to say every game you can win.
Sure.
So I
am less picky than Walker. I really appreciate it when a game is super difficult. QV, my recent comments on Regicide. But I also don't mind co-op games that are too easy. QV, Spirit Island, and difficulty level 0.
Yeah, well, we just talked about that with Regicide, right?
Yep.
With if you want to make it easier, then just make it easier for yourself.
Yeah. Who is your favorite Street Masters fighter, and why is it Grill? Well, my favorite's Grill, and it's Grill because Grill is awesome. He's a gecko judoka. What else could you possibly want? I only have one criticism of Grill, though, and this is incredibly nerdy, and everyone prepare to roll your eyes. And that is that Grill is very good at crowd control, namely taking care of lots of small minions at once, which is not what Judo is good at. That's more of an Aikido kind of thing, but I'm willing to forgive it because Grill is awesome. What about you, Walker?
It's funny. I read it the other way around. I just read it as who is your favorite Street Master character and why? I forgot it was. I didn't read the Grill part. I think I just briefed over it. Mine was it's the same answer to both. giant panda.
Giant panda, yeah, Chan Chan, yeah. I also, my second favorite, though, is definitely Axel. And if for what it's worth, Axel is the best designer insert I've ever seen in a game. It kind of has a bit of that look of this is a real human that's been inserted into a board game, but I'm willing to forgive it also because just how effective he is. Because Grill is, the one thing I have against Grill in terms of effectiveness, Grill is not a support character. Axel is. I enjoy support characters. Will we see Swag Presents Masterpiece Theater branching out into other franchises? I don't know.
Who knows? If something strikes us as silly, then I can almost guarantee 100% it will.
Yeah, I don't think we're not going to branch out into like genuine media criticism. That's not going to happen.
Although, like I said earlier, definitely check out our MySpace area and you'll find some very interesting stuff there.
Is there a board game on your shelf that is there for purely nostalgic purposes? No real plans to get it played again?
Not after the Purge.
Not after the Purge. Well, there's still... Okay, so there's still War Room. Do you plan on getting War Room to the table ever?
Yes.
Okay, well, I wish you luck. Well, no, I'm not going to be there. Not like I wouldn't play it. I'd happily play War Room. For me, there are a couple of... because I'm a collector with a huge collection, I feel like I have the luxury of keeping things around just to the off chance. And so some of them effectively are for nostalgia purposes because there's no local people who would want to play it. A salient example of this is La Révolution Française, La Patrie en Danger, which is a 5-6 player negotiation game about the French Revolution. I don't know if there are enough locals that would be interested in spending 6 hours with that particular rule set, but I'm never going to get rid of it.
This is for you, Mark. I strongly enjoyed The Good Place TV show, found the integration of philosophy interesting. Do you have a suggestion for someone looking to dip their toe into philosophy?
Depends on what you're looking for. If you want a very accessible, albeit slanted, summary of a lot of Western philosophy, you can read Bertrand Russell's The History of Philosophy. Bertrand Russell is someone with whom I do not see eye to eye in many things, except for pacifism. I'm down with his pacifism. And his history of philosophy is very much like, here are a whole bunch of thinkers from the past and why they were wrong and the ways they disagreed with me, but it's eminently readable. If you want to get started in my fields, namely German metaphysics and ethics, then The Grounding for the Metaphysics of Morals by Immanuel Kant is probably the single greatest thing ever written. And if you can find it, The Vocation of Humankind by Fichte is a great introduction to German idealism. I highly, highly recommend it. Very readable and also very strange, but in a very characteristic German idealism kind of way.
What? Sorry.
Walker, did you complete your quest to clear your shelves? There was some discussion a while back about a purge.
Well, we talked about that a lot already, and will it happen again? Yes, the shelves are quickly filling again. I think this will be once you get back in a year, we will probably assess the entire situation and discuss on how to deal with it.
The Purge 2, the repurgening.
Hey, we can do like a little Patreon push here. If you add a certain tier, you get free games.
We already have that.
That's what I'm saying. We have it.
Yeah.
That's one people know we have.
Okay,
it.
Well, fair enough.
It's a good way to get rid of some of these games.
This isn't a multiple of five. We can't plug the Patreon here.
It was very, very small. It wasn't really
a tiny plug, a plugette. We dislike Terraforming Mars. Well, I dislike Terraforming Mars. Walker has his misgivings, but still enjoy it. And there have I tried the app? No, I haven't tried the app.
Well, I like the app for everything that this guy has talked about. Solo, playing it by yourself, quickly throw in some, you know, AI opponents, blast through a game and just minutes, it's not terrible.
Yeah, it just doesn't do anything for me. This is one reason why, not a reason to go into the deep dive, but having been in the hobby for over 20 years, and I've been playing tableau builders, many of them by Tom Lehman for this period, and Terraforming Mars comes up, I'm like, other than theme, which is not nothing.
That's what I was going to counter with. It's the theme that
100%. We reviewed Terraforming Mars, I think it was episode 3 or something, and at the time I acknowledged, look, it's a hard sci-fi theme, sort of a near future with plausible technologies, and that's a tremendous amount of the appeal. So good on them for that. But other than that, I don't really see any reason to prefer it over, you know, take your pick, 51st State Master Set, especially Race to the Galaxy. You know, there are many. Anyway.
What does Mark find compelling about the Napoleonic period of history?
Part of it is because I had a very, very influential history teacher named Roman Yaromowicz, who gave me a love of Napoleonics. He was a big fan of the Napoleonic Wars. Part of it is, honestly, as a pacifist, I appreciate its absurdity. Not to minimize the human toll that took place, but you're talking about, you know, a couple hundred thousand men dressed in beautiful uniforms that would line up opposed to each other on a field and very, you know, in a very civilized way, murder each other. Part of that I kind of appreciate. I also really like the combined arms that was involved. It was the last gasp of heavy infantry in a very serious way. You know, there's a number of things that you see kind of almost for the last time in that era.
I find just all history compelling. I love playing almost all history games.
Tell us about the Dinosaur Walkers.
Nope. What solo games are you finding handed? What solo games are you finding hitting the table in the last couple months?
I've been playing a lot of Imperium Classics and Imperium Legends, honestly. The solo mode is really good, and it's not super quick, but it's sufficiently quick, and you just get to play with all the cards. I've also been playing Friedman Freese's Finished and a whole lot of Street Masters.
Yeah, nothing's the actual table. How about the screen? Did a lot of Fairy Tale, a lot of Fantasy Realms. For things that are actually hitting the table, I've been pulling out Dice Miner once in a while because it's very quick to play. But something that's going to be hitting the table a lot more will be Spire's End coming up. Is there a game that you've been longing to play but haven't had the opportunity or the right situation?
Oh, so many.
We've already talked about the War Room, and we've already talked about Level 7 Invasion. Those are the two that I have here.
I really want to play Westphalia by Amabel Holland. When there was some possibility of getting six people together and one of them was Walker, Walker said, you can go ahead and play Westphalia. I'm going to be somewhere else. Makes me sad. Makes me deeply, deeply sad. And again, I talked about this on the newsletter, Oath and Sleeping Gods. We have copies. We just never came together. We were never really able to get groups or the time together for a push. So there's that.
Do you do house rules? If so, are there any you consider mandatory? Would you make up a house rule for a game you like, one and one for a game you dislike, spontaneously? Ask listeners to try them.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that.
No.
But we talked about this. This was one of our early topics, actually, and we both expressed the view that house rules, there's a very high bar for them. You need to have a very serious problem to address the house rule. I know some people that house rule games all the time. Sometimes simple fixes like if there's going to be a face-up market, just always have a bigger face-up market on the basis that that's advantageous. Or some people just start fiddling with games before they've even finished the first play. These people are barbarians. But I do have a house rule for Tribune, which is my favorite worker placement game. Don't start with any leaders. And I have a minor house rule for Asgard's Chosen, which is somewhat similar. Nobody can start with a strength 4 monster. Any time where you can just start out with random goods that have serious knock-on effects for the rest of the game, I find that a little bit disadvantageous. And it's like, well, you know, in the first round, I was able to do these 5 amazing things just because I happened to set up in this way randomly. Nah, not a fan.
No, I remember having house rules, but now having... And this was like 20 years ago, and now having been much heavier in board games, realize that those house rules are silly and foolish.
Well, that is going to do it for this round of questions. There are yet more questions to be answered, and if you want more, well, just send them in and we'll consider them. Thank you very much for joining us for this special episode of So Wrong About Games.
Join us at our guild on Board Game Geek, which is guild number 3236. Check out our Patreon page and our Twitch feed. You can find us also on Facebook. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.
Proof that you listen to me. Wow.
How was that?
Well, actually, we won't necessarily see you the next week. We don't know when the next episode is going to be.
Sorry, I messed up the very end. I'm so sorry. I
thought I fumbled at the 5-yard line. Thanks very much, and we will see you again soon.
And then you're supposed to say peace.
No, that's not how this works.
Oh, but I said, okay. Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soverywrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.